Well, I wonder where you watched the royal wedding. Did you watch it? Yes. Well, we watched it in bed from the 62nd floor of our hotel in New York. We woke up quite early because of the time difference, and we switched the telly on in our hotel room, and the lovely Meghan had just arrived at the front of the church and the hymn had started. And we must admit, we watched it on Fox News. We just thought, I wonder if they're going to interrupt with really banal American stuff every 5 minutes. And, you know, are we going to have a commercial break every 2 minutes? As we hadn't watched any other telly while we were there because it's so awful. But actually, to give them their due, they did not say a word and they did not interrupt it once, which we were pleasantly surprised about. And we were enjoying watching what was going on and celebrity spotting and seeing what everyone was wearing, as I'm sure you all were. And then that sermon happened. Now, if you've been on any kind of social media or the news or reading the newspapers, you will know that that sermon has caused quite a stir. Praise God. That sermon has probably more public conversation than any sermon preached since perhaps Billy Graham first came to Britain. That sermon took people by surprise, including us. We were cheering at the screen on the 62nd floor. It caused those celebrities to stop people watching and to sit up and take notice. Did you see their faces? Wasn't it wonderful? And that sermon has caused people in the media to reflect on the power of preaching in a way that hasn't been seen for generations. And regardless of what we thought about what Bishop Curry said, this has got to be good news, hasn't it, for a church that feels politically side-railed often, and for preachers like myself who worry that their craft is becoming irrelevant in the bigger social sphere. And yet, for all that fantastic conversation, as ever, everyone was impressed. I was reading a very helpful piece about it. Baptist ministers get something called the Baptist Roundup every month. And in there, there were several articles about this sermon. And there were ministers and preachers reflecting on why they'd been so encouraged by the sermon itself and by the world's reaction to it. But also, sadly, how certain very religious people had been so scathing about it. It seems that for some people, pointing to a God who loves them in a 13-minute sermon, and 13 minutes is not very long, being relayed to the whole world is just not enough. For some people, unless he covers the whole doctrine of sin and redemption, he is not just falling short, but I sadly have heard some people claim that he was preaching a false Christ. Now, I don't doubt that if you are a theologian, you can probably pore over what Bishop Curry said and find some gaps. He only had 13 minutes. But how helpful is it really to take apart a sermon which has caused celebrity atheists to publicly tweet that they may have to rethink their stance on Christianity? And I'm afraid this kind of backbiting sounds to me all too familiar. Because where love is poured out and celebrated in such a public way, there are often sanctimonious voices calling for people to be more sensible, to get the message right. And in fact, we have a really good example of just that kind of behaviour in the passage that Rhiannon read for us this morning. Bishop Curry can take great comfort from the thought that Jesus wasn't orthodox enough or complete enough for some of his disciples either. So what we see in the opening verses of this story is that the religious elite had really got it in for Jesus. He was just going to have to go. It wasn't just that he was dangerous, stirring up crowds and causing disturbances that might make the Romans clamp down on everyone. It was his absolute disregard for the rules that they just couldn't bear. The rules were there for a reason, a very important reason. And in a religious nation defined by purity, it was imperative that the undesirable, the unclean, were definitely kept out. And Jesus was absolutely hopeless in this area, wasn't he? He was always eating with the wrong sorts, healing people who were obvious sinners, touching people who should never be touched. The man was a liability. And as for his teaching, well, it was just not good enough. There was no appreciation for the need for obeying the law. He was going around forgiving people everywhere, giving them a completely false idea about the seriousness of their sin. He never preached a whole sermon outlining his whole mission. Instead, it was, as many have said of Bishop Curry, theology light, where most of the time he just told stories. Well, no wonder the crowds loved him. Who wouldn't love someone that gave them free food and told them how they could know God just because he loved them so much? Well, one of the criticisms that has been laid at Bishop Curry's door is that his sermon was crowd-pleasing. And in our Gospels, Jesus is often described as preaching to the crowds. And the word in English doesn't really do justice to the original word in Greek, oklos, which translated, we have simply as crowd, is actually a much more condescending word. It really means a mob or a rabble. It refers to the poor and despised, the people without a shepherd, the wanderers and the homeless. These are Jesus' crowd. And perhaps in the same way, the sermon at the wedding was preaching to just such a crowd. They may have been very well turned out, but these people are just as lost and poor in any real sense of the word as the hoi polloi that followed Jesus around. These smart people with their titles and their celebrity status are just as much in need of the message of love as any of the sick and poor that flocked to hear Jesus. And just as there was a big reaction to the message of love preached in Windsor last week, so there were big reactions to the love that Jesus preached too. And as is always the case, the ones who had previously felt the least loved had the biggest reason to pour love back over Jesus. And so we come to the woman in our story. On the face of it, it doesn't look like such a big event, does it? Jesus, as usual, is having dinner with exactly the wrong sorts of people. Simon the leper this time. Eternally grateful for Jesus healing him of a disease that would have been a slow and lonely death in those days. He throws a party in honor of Jesus. And what happens next has happened before. Women who were so used in Jesus' time to being abused, ignored, and generally talked down to, absolutely loved Jesus. Here was a man who actually took notice of them. Not only that, but he spoke to them as though God was actually interested in them too. He seemed to understand their worries and troubles and even forgave their most private and shameful sins. Women were often grateful to Jesus. And yet Jesus tells us something staggering about this particular grateful woman. He tells us that she will always be remembered. Now Jesus doesn't say this about anyone else we come across in the Gospels, so we should really sit up and take notice here. What is it about this woman's attitude that means she should always be remembered? Well, I think there are three things. Firstly, she understands why Jesus has come. Now, one of the things that is often thrown at people who do irrational and extravagant things for God is that they just haven't understood all the complexities of the situation. And yet, in a room of disciples who just will not listen to Jesus when he tells them repeatedly that he's going to die, this woman has grasped what is going to happen next. Not only does she understand that Jesus has come to die, she decides to worship Jesus because of it and help prepare him for it. Now, we should be very careful that we don't fall into the same trap as the disciples when we assume that new Christians haven't really understood all the complexities of our faith. This woman, like so many new Christians, got it better than the ones who were closest to Jesus. Hers was an emotional response to a truth that she didn't just know, but one that she had experienced. She may not have been able to explain it or to discuss the theology of it, but she knew how to respond to it. And we need to remember the basics. Remember the amazing love that called us into our own relationship with Jesus. And when we do, if it doesn't cause us to fall on our knees and pour whatever is our heart's treasure at his feet, then maybe we need to ask ourselves if we had ever really got it in the first place. Secondly, this woman is persecuted for her love of Jesus. What this woman does to Jesus is very public and very dramatic. And what she gets for it is persecution. There she is, pouring out her heart for Jesus, and all anyone can hear is the sound of the disciples tutting and murmuring about the waste. They are quite happy to make her feel a real idiot for using her perfume all in one go on Jesus. Not only that, but they want to accuse her of immoral waste too. And I don't know if you've noticed, but it's always a good move if you want to make yourself look good to bring in the poor on your side of the argument. And of course, what we know about that particular gripe is that Judas, who was looking after the money, wasn't at all interested in giving the money to the poor, because the gospel writers tell us that he was already helping himself to that bag of money. The shame they try to pour on this woman is completely unjustified, and Jesus defends her. Now, when we think about the persecuted church, and we do think about them often, and it is right and proper to do so, we often think about the terrible places where Christians are put in prison or worse for their faith. I think it is really encouraging to know that Jesus stands up for this woman when she's just being made to feel foolish. How often have we dissolved into the background of a conversation because we know that speaking out will make us look a fool? We can castigate ourselves for this, and we do often, don't we? But I wonder if part of the reason Jesus wanted this woman remembered is so that we who have felt foolish ourselves can see that Jesus takes this kind of humiliation seriously. He speaks up for her and honours her. And he will do the same for us every time we feel a fool for standing up for our love of Jesus. Thirdly, she holds nothing back. Of course, the main reason Jesus wants us to remember her is the same reason he points out the woman who gave her last penny in the collection. Do you remember her? She follows on from the people who flamboyantly put hundreds of pounds into the money box, and she puts her last tiny small coin in, And Jesus points out to his disciples that actually it's her, not the others, who have given the most. You see, Jesus is only really interested in a response that holds nothing back. For this woman, in this place, at this time, this jar of perfume represented something huge. This nard would have been part of her dowry, probably a huge part of her dowry. She would have been expected to use it all her life. For every death in the family, every time they came to anoint a body, for every special occasion, her role as a woman in society is to turn up with her jar of perfume. And what she is saying, by pouring it all out on Jesus in one go, is that no matter who comes in or out of her life at this point or thereafter, no one will ever be as important as Jesus is to her. No parent, no husband, no child will be as precious to her as he is in that moment. Well, no wonder people were embarrassed. This kind of devotion makes Simon's meal look like a very miserly thank you compared to the amazing smells wafting around the room from this woman's perfume. The smell of sacrifice and adoration is very uncomfortable if you are trying to look as though you are all in, but really you are keeping the best bits to yourself. Now, we might find it difficult to find a sacrifice to compare with what that woman poured all over Jesus. In our complicated society, our wealth and our self-esteem is spread over so many things, isn't it? And we as women have so many complicated lives, so many different things that give us standing in society. We are not clinging to a jar of perfume to make us mean something. We have many areas of our life that give us that kind of self-esteem. And yet, what Jesus wants from us does not change. He has given his all for us. And anything less in return just shows that we haven't understood the question. So maybe we should ask ourselves, what is it that we are holding back? In the jar of perfume of our lives, which bits do we keep in the bathroom cabinet for a rainy day? What areas of our lives do we consider not of interest to God or even off limits to God? Maybe it's our money. Maybe it's our children. Maybe it's our career. Maybe it's our retirement. And maybe even it's our ministry. It is so easy to put all those things on the altar before God, to give him everything, and then to gradually forget how much he's done for us and to gradually pull those things back to ourselves. I wonder what it would feel like if we regularly broke the jar of those treasures and pour them at his feet. And of course, the ironic thing about keeping things from God is that however precious they are to us, they are much more to him. And however much we think we can use them and honour them, he is sure to outdo us 100-fold if we give them to him. Because the truth I think Jesus wants us to understand from this woman's pouring out of her perfume over Jesus is that if we want to be remembered, we have to let go. We have to let go of the stuff that makes us feel important. We have to let go of the stuff that makes us feel like we can't be important. We have to give all of that stuff to Jesus, the the stuff that makes us feel loved, the stuff that makes us feel safe. We have to pour that at his feet. And in giving it all up to Jesus, we have a chance of it being used in the best possible way and with eternal consequences. I wonder how many of this woman's friends' perfume bottles were remembered beyond the next day of their use. And yet hers, so extravagantly wasted, has been remembered for 2,000 years. The smell of it wafts through the years to us as a sign of sacrifice and love for Jesus. So don't hold back. Let's learn to express the love that we have for Jesus in return for the love that he had for us. And then, maybe like Bishop Currie last Saturday, we might get everyone talking.